Page 328. Thus, for Kant, nature is not to console man for frustrations, but to stimulate his moral and intellectual development. In Hamsun, the relation of a man to nature takes on an entirely different cast. I stood in the shelter of an overhanging rock, thinking many things. My soul was tense, heaven knows. I thought to myself, what is it I am watching here, and why the sea should open before my eyes? Maybe I am seeing now the inner brain of earth, how things are at work there, boiling and foaming. Footnote 18, text. The locus of knowledge has become nature itself, mysterious and beyond man's capacities to know. Hamsun's questions are framed so they cannot be answered. His tired individuals seek to silence themselves as quickly as possible. They really have nothing to say, and they welcome the storm that can roar loudly enough to drown out their own silence. The relationship of man to nature as seen by Kant is reversed. For Hamsun, the storm serves as an occasion for increasing the individual's awareness of his own insignificance. When a moment of sadness and realization of my own nothingness in the face of all the surrounding powers comes over me, I lament and think, which man I am now, or am I perhaps lost and perhaps no longer existent? And I speak aloud and call my name in order to hear whether he is still present. Footnote 19, text. Anxiety enters as a component of Hamsun's pantheism. Kant's pride in human autonomy is replaced by a sentimental uneasiness that is announced in every thunderstorm and that is subsequently ramified as a jumble of mawkish sympathies for both natural objects and spiritual difficulties. Footnote 20, text. Hamsun's nature world foreshadows the affinity of brutality and sentimentality as well a well-known phenomenon in Nazi Germany. Rhythm. When Hamsun speaks of nature, it is generally the forest and the sea. In the world of the forest, the law of rhythm, another significant element in Hamsun's imagery of nature, emerges. There is nothing more glorious than the thawing of the woods. It is like swinging, rocking, a madness. Uganda, Antananarivo, Honolulu, Atacama, Venezuela. Footnote 21. Text. Page 329. The countries and cities have no concrete significance. What is essential is the sound of their names, which serves only to evoke and echo the order of natural motion. The rhythmic cycle of the seasons is also incessantly noted in the novels, where hypnotic prose again seems to imitate the phenomenon itself. Then came the autumn, then came the winter. Footnote 22, text. But the road leads on, summer follows spring in the world. Footnote 23, text. The days passed, time passed. Footnote 24, text. Innumerable sentences of this kind sometimes takes the form of a linguistic leitmotif, such as the ruthlessness of life, the procession of the seasons, the march of time, the men who go over the field or walk along the road, the measured steps of life, and so forth. Footnote 25, text. Elsewhere, we find the seasonal and the daily rhythms unified. It is the autumn season now, a silence in the woods all around. The hills are there, the sun is there, and at evening the moon and the stars will come, all regular and certain, full of kindliness and embrace. Footnote 26, text. The rhythmic principle can also take a normative character. What is wrong with certain people is that they won't keep pace with life, but There's none should rage against life. Footnote 27. Text. Even men's sexual relationships are oriented to the regularity of nature. The shepherdess will walk past the hunter's cabin in the autumn just as infallibly as she comes to him in the spring. The autumn, the winter, had laid hold of her too, her senses drowsed. Footnote 28. Text. Uniformity of rhythm and tempo is sought in both the natural and human spheres. The passage of time brings recurrence and not change. Page 330. Nature's timetable replaces the timetable of history. This tendency displays the same simplification that is found in Hamsun's selection of landscapes. Whoever senses and accepts these rhythmic patterns as fundamental has full knowledge immediately and without rational effort. At the same time, the endless reproduction of natural phenomena, the cyclic order of nature as opposed to the apparent disorder and happenstance of all individual and historical facts, testifies to the powerlessness of man. It is the extreme opposite of human self-assurance before nature. In this new ideology, which seeks to transfigure helplessness in subjection, the individual in seemingly free volition lays down his arms before a mystical power. Once nature was held to be autonomous, only insofar as it was not yet recreated as the product of human activity. Now, however, man must expect a life without meaning, unless he obediently accepts as his own what may be called the law of nature, and the social counterpart of the law of natural rhythm is blind discipline. Hero worship. When Hamsun speaks of the forces of nature to which man should subject himself, it is, as we have noted, mostly of the woods and the sea. But when he speaks of man himself as he should be, he leaves these unspoiled provinces behind and speaks foremost of farming. Hamsun's emphasis is not upon the social conditions of the farm, rather he is again involved in constructing the myth which demands the necessity of man's submission to nature. The peasant tunes himself to forces stronger than himself, and that is supposed to be the lesson he can teach us. In addition, vigorous youth and women are portrayed as truly obedient to nature's forces. Hamsun gives us, in fact, a gallery of unheroic heroes whose qualities are primarily those of subjection and discipline. The peasant. Hamsun's peasants are not individuals. They are aspects of nature, and his apparent admiration of them is not a love of man, but a reverence for the domination of nature over its inhabitants. His, the peasant's, life was spent in this work and that, according to the season, from the fields to the woods and back to the fields again. Footnote 29, text. This sentence is typical. The peasant himself is not characterized. He is presented only as a natural phenomenon that comes and goes like the blossoming and withering of the leaves in the forest. Page 331. That is precisely the identity which Hamsun seeks, an identity established by nature, not by man. Looking up at blue peaks every day of our lives, no newfangled inventions about that, but fields and rocky peaks rooted deep in the past, but you've them for a companionship. There you are, living in touch with heaven and earth, one with them, one with all these wide, deep-rooted things. Footnote 30, text. The course of history is reversed. Man and nature don't bombard each other. Footnote 31, text. In Hamsun's Nature has no place for the individual as such. His irrelevancy is not only described but glorified in the person of the peasant, who is reduced to a biological speck in the rhythm of life. 'Tis you that maintain life, generation to generation, breeding ever anew, and when you die, the new stock goes on. That's the meaning of eternal life. Footnote 32, text. Daniel is the name of this peasant, but any other peasant could serve as well. Daniel was the same today as yesterday. Footnote 33, text. And the elements in nature with which the peasant deals are always the same too. Wherever there was a tiny patch of fertile ground, their hay or potatoes or barley grew. In summer, the cattle were out in the pasture. In winter, they stood in their stalls. It was all so eternal and so changeless. Footnote 34, text. In the course of the flight to nature, Hamsun's individual is stripped of his singular human qualities and subjected to eternal naturalness. 'Tis the land I'm here for. Footnote 35, text. Service to nature is the real law of peasant life, and happiness means only that he has fulfilled his naturalistic destiny. Only submission to the laws of nature that dictate, for example, the cultivation of grain makes man an admirable figure. Growth of the soil was something different, a thing to be procured at any cost, the only source, the origin of all. Footnote 36, text. For generations back, in forgotten time, his fathers before him had sowed corn solemnly on a still, calm evening. Corn was nothing less than bread. Corn or no corn meant life or death. Page 332. The products of cities are devaluated or totally ignored in a kind of travesty of the theories of the physiocrats. There isn't a human being anywhere in the world who can live on banks and industries, not a single human being in the world. Oh, what do they live on then? On three things and nothing else, replies Ezra. On the grain of the fields, the fish of the sea, and the birds and beasts of the forest. On those three things, I've thought it all out. There's quite a few that live on their money. No, said Ezra, not a single soul. Footnote 38, text. As contrasted with the emptiness of urban existence, the concreteness of the peasant's world seemed to compromise the meaning of life itself. He did not feel poor and forlorn, as he really was, while all the stones he had cleared looked just like a crowd of people around him. He was personally related to every stone. They were acquaintances, every one. He had conquered them and got them out of the ground. Footnote 39, text. The authoritarian state did not have to invent the idea of man roots as being in blood and soil, nor devise the manipulation of this slogan as a solace for want. We will not be any happier if we eat more bacon, says Hamsun's peasant in defending life on Norwegian soil against a life outside that might mean greater material success. The worst fate is to be torn up by the roots from our own barren soil and transplanted into richer. Footnote 40, text. If we accept this belief, we do not scorn the hardest labor, for we know where we really do belong. Footnote 41, after labor, and footnote 42, after really do belong. Text. It is a good thing to belong to one's class, otherwise one becomes an upstart and gets one's originality frittered away. Footnote 43, text. A good thing if you are a peasant, that is, Hamsun's eulogy of the peasant apparently undertaken in the spirit of social critique ends up as a sermon of temperance, humility, and privation. Page 333. The message is